that can be enough to tip the whole international scene. And that's got to be good news, because for too long, for decades, we've been operating, trying to get to a point where we get everybody to agree on everything, and repeatedly reminding ourselves that that's almost impossible to achieve.
Do listeners need a science degree to read the new Tipping Point report?
It's longer than I hoped it would be, but no, we've worked really hard to write in an accessible language. We've tried to use quite a lot of infographics, and we've tried to offer the report in little broken down chunks if you just want to pick off bits of it. We've produced some video content, animations, and other ways of just trying to offer interested listeners a way in to just learning about this stuff. So yeah, please get stuck in, and I hope we've got something to offer for everybody. And if you want the detail, it's undoubtedly there as well.
Our guest, Dr. Timothy Lenton, is a world leader in the field and chair in climate change and earth system science at the University of Exeter. Listeners, this is a gold mine of Tipping Point information. It's ready for you at globaltippingpoints.org. You put a hyphen between the words global and tipping and tipping and points, and it will work for you. Or grab the link from my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim Lenton, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thanks so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Former NASA chief scientist James Hansen tells us not to count carbon nor measure heat. Look at the Earth energy imbalance. Reflective sea ice has crashed in both the Arctic and Antarctica. Has the energy balance changed at the poles? It turns out energy transaction at the poles is key to the movement of warmer air and ocean currents from the equator toward the temperate latitudes where most humans live. There is new science with answers. We will talk with the lead author, Hamish Prince. But I warn you, this important development is not easy to understand. That is partly because scientists are observing not from the surface, but at the top of the atmosphere, hundreds of miles upward toward space. That makes some assumptions down here sound backward. Just as a first glimpse, this is from the American Meteorological Society Journal press release, quote, "The Antarctic is absorbing more energy than the Arctic. Satellite data show differences in how the Arctic and Antarctic are responding to increased temperatures, according to a new paper by Hamish Prince and Tristan Lecuyer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Both poles are receiving increased solar energy input as melting sea ice reduces the region's reflectivity. This may affect the temperature gradient between the poles and the temperate regions that drives much of the climate system. This study finds that the warming Arctic is emitting a nearly comparable amount of this increased heat back to space, leaving the region's net energy imbalance largely unchanged despite rapid ice melt. However, the Antarctic is not emitting more heat energy to space, implying the solar radiation is being absorbed," end quote from the American Meteorological Society press release in mid-March 2024. So let us investigate these polar changes and what they mean for future climate.
Radio EcoShock.
The poles of Earth release more heat back to space than they get. This energy flow draws from the hot equator, motivating winds and ocean currents for all of us. Is that polar energy system going out of balance? Yes, but not how you might expect. In February, the American Meteorological Society published a new perspective. The lead author is Hamish D. Prince, a New Zealand Fulbright scholar and now at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Hamish Prince, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Yes, well, to begin, former NASA chief scientist James Hansen tells us not to count carbon or measure heat. Look at the Earth energy imbalance. Why did you choose to examine energy gain or loss at the poles?
Yeah, I 100% agree with that statement. Energy is the most fundamental aspect of the Earth system. All aspects of our climate are driven by this energy balance. From the temperature of our planet to the weather we experience are all controlled by the energy Earth receives and emits. Importantly, this continuous greenhouse gas emission is having a direct impact on Earth's energy balance that we experience as global warming. But in the polar regions, there are additional processes such as sea ice loss that further change the balance of this energy. As sea ice melts, it exposes much darker ocean underneath, increasing the amount of sunlight that is absorbed and which is experienced as warming in that region. We wanted to examine the trend of these energetic responses in these polar regions, in both polar regions, the Arctic and Antarctica, through satellite records.
What is the top of the atmosphere? Where is it? And what tools can measure energy flows there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the top of the atmosphere is considered as a location up in space far above the Earth. It is the point above all of atmospheric phenomenon, above the weather we experience and the gases in the atmosphere. In practice, this just means that we're using measurements from satellites, typically around 500 miles above the Earth, just a bit higher than the International Space Station. It's a bit like thinking of the Earth as a snow globe, and we're on the outside of the glass looking back at all the fluid and complex things happening on the inside. On a more technical side of things, it also means that minimal data processing is occurring. Estimating things like surface temperature or cloud cover from space is a bit complicated, but by taking a perspective from the top of the atmosphere, we can take measurements from these sensors that have very high confidence.
Dr. Seiji Kato is a scientist at NASA's Langley Research Center. He often co-authors papers with Hansen. In 2006, working with just 4 years of satellite data, Kato and colleagues discovered something unexpected in the warming Arctic. Is your work further proof of that early study, and what is the surprise?
Yes, so in that early study, they found from a limited satellite record that loss of sea ice would increase absorbed sunlight, but they suggested that increasing cloud cover might compensate for that. However, our results don't show that, and that might not be entirely true, that solar absorption is certainly increasing in the Arctic with 15 more years of data, that increasing cloud cover is not directly balancing the more exposed ocean and increased warming from sea ice. But clouds do mask the trend a little, making it a bit less pronounced, but they're certainly not compensating for the lack of sea ice, which that earlier study in 2006 suggested.
I must have had a misunderstanding reading the paper. I thought that the Arctic was more or less in balance.
Yeah, so this is a great question and an important point to clarify. So it's about following the energy around. And so we have seen sunlight absorbed into the region, and usually that's reflected away. And in a normal climate, that might just be where the story ends. But in our current world, sea ice has been removed, and so more of that energy has been absorbed into the ocean. When we say the energy is being balanced, we're saying that that warming is going into emitting, that increased sunlight is going into warming the surface and increasing the thermal emission. The important bit of science here is that warmer objects emit more thermal radiation, and that is what we are measuring. And so when we're saying the Arctic is remaining in balance, we are saying that the increased absorbed solar radiation is going directly into warming the surface, which we can see from space.
What is your assessment of the climatic or energy impacts of the crash in summer sea ice in the Arctic? What do you think it does there?
Yeah, so firstly, is this direct impact that we've been discussing, that with a lot less sea ice, you absorb more solar radiation and you warm that surface. And it actually kicks off a positive feedback, because as you remove that sea ice, you warm the surface, which can further melt more sea ice. And that's known as the ice albedo feedback, where albedo is the term for the reflectivity. And this warming has dramatic impacts on the local ecology and communities in this region. And this is exactly what we have seen in the last 20, 30, even 40 years, that this feedback has been kicking off and our ice is further and further reducing every year. The global impacts of this are a bit more complex. A warming polar region decreases the equator to pole temperature gradient, which would certainly expect to have an impact on the climate, but that is very uncertain and is the focus of a lot of ongoing research.
I know scientists worry about a blue ocean event where most of the sea ice is gone from the Arctic Ocean, at least during summer. And researchers from the Scripps Institution at the University of California in San Diego calculated that a blue ocean event would increase energy in the atmosphere comparable to 1 trillion tons of CO2, And that would be like adding 25 years of emissions. But your study, does it throw doubt on such a large impact of a blue ocean event?
No, I'd say our paper does not throw doubt onto this, but it further reinforces the statements that they're making. In that study, they looked at what an ice freak Arctic would cause, the potential warming of that through absorbed sunlight. And we just show that absorbed sunlight is directly related to the surface warming from these satellite records. The key point to keep in mind is that thermal emission that we discuss is directly proportional to the temperature at the surface. So when we say that the thermal emission is increasing at the same rate, that is equal to saying the temperature is also increasing proportionally to the increased solar radiation. We just show from the observational record that their assumptions hold very true in this current 20-year record we have.
Well, that's pretty concerning. All right, let's switch to the other end of the Earth here. If we switch to Antarctica, the technical language became for me a bit confusing. It sounds like more energy is being absorbed in Antarctica, but that is called an energy deficit. But then I realized, well, the deficit takes place not at the surface, but the whole point of view is at the top of the atmosphere. Is that right?
Yeah, so the important point is that the Arctic and Antarctica are always in an energy deficit. But as we absorb more sunlight, that deficit is reducing. We need to think a bit like an accountant here, that maybe we always lose 100 watts of energy from the region. But with absorbed solar radiation, that amount of energy being lost is being reduced, that only 80 watts are being lost every year, that the region is not losing energy as easily, that more solar radiation is being absorbed, and it's an extra source of energy into our account of all energy in the region. I hope that clarifies that.
So if I'm looking at the map that's in your paper, we have green at the poles and then warmer temperatures, obviously, around the equator and the tropics. It's just hard for us to grasp that energy is leaking away back into space more from the poles, which we think of as cold, than from the tropics.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so when we do this balance, we think about absorbed sunlight versus the emitted thermal radiation. And in the tropical regions of the planet, there is a lot of sunlight being absorbed. They're facing directly towards the sun, and it's highly concentrated solar radiation in the equator regions. And that's what gives us our warm temperatures there. But then the atmosphere and the ocean are really effective of distributing their energy around the planet, and it sends it polewards into the colder regions. And so you can think of the climate on a very basic sense as just one big cycle of energy coming into the equator, flowing towards the poles and exiting through our polar regions on a very basic sense. And so that's how we describe the deficit in the polar regions, that the energy is flowing from the equator into the polar regions and being emitted back to space. And it is the lack of solar absorption that keeps it in a deficit.
That's very interesting. I really did not realize that that was how it works. So in the paper, there is a helpful diagram and comparison between the Arctic as a shallow bathtub and the Antarctic as an energy sink. Could you expand on that for us, please, Hamish?
Yeah, so we tried to summarize our ideas in this more analogy and this schematically made. So if you imagine a shallow bathtub of water and you were to start heating that up with a heater above it, you would feel the warmth on that water. That water is trapped in the bathtub and you will feel it warming up. This is a similar idea to removing sea ice in the Arctic. Removing the sea ice allows the sun to start warming the surface, like a heater warming the shallow bathtub, and we feel that warmth in the ocean. But if you're meant to imagine a sink of water flowing around and flowing down the drain, this is our analogy of a southern ocean. If you were to start warming that ocean, that water with a heater that's flowing around and flowing down a drain, you won't feel that water heating up because it's been taken away from the surface by the ocean circulation. And that's our analogy for Antarctica. As you remove that sea ice, you can start warming that water, but it's been taken up by the ocean through a process of ocean heat uptake. And it's highly effective around Antarctica, and that's why we're not seeing warming occurring in the oceans around Antarctica as the sea ice is being reduced. That extra energy is being taken away deep into the ocean. It's flowing around the sink of energy.
Major media worldviews, as we know, come from the Northern Hemisphere, and picturing geoengineering, like injecting reflective particles into the atmosphere, we generally would see that as happening over the Arctic. But if sea ice loss has not substantially affected the energy balance over the North Polar area, but affects Antarctica more, does this imply we should inject the particles over Antarctica, really?
I think the important point to clarify here is that more solar absorption anywhere on the planet is going to add energy to our to our climate system. It will cause warming somewhere on the planet. And so in Antarctica, when we're saying that it's not really affecting the surface temperatures because their energy is going deep into the Southern Ocean, warming temperatures away from us to a place that we can't measure, that we aren't measuring. And so the absorption of solar radiation is consequential on our climate wherever that occurs. But we show that that warming is occurring in different places between the Arctic and the Antarctic through different geophysical processes. In terms of the geoengineering component, I certainly can't discuss. I'm not qualified to look at its plausibility. Our research doesn't address that.
Right. So many of our guests caution uncertainty about clouds lead to significant uncertainty about how climate change will develop. Suppose Arctic warming leads to more water vapor and so to more clouds and so less energy absorption, a kind of counter-cooling effect brought on by warming. Is that what you think is happening?
I definitely agree with you that clouds are the biggest uncertainty in the climate system, and we also address that in that paper. But this assumption that reducing sea ice will continue to increase cloud cover is highly uncertain. And like that earlier study from 2006, they suggested that this might be a consequential process, but we don't think that is the case. While they do mask a bit of the variability, we're not seeing them completely counter the warming of reducing sea ice.
So with only 20-plus years of satellite records, is it still possible energy at the poles is influenced by longer cycles and might change again in unpredictable ways?
Yeah, this is an important point. I'm glad you brought it up. Through this interview, I've been talking about ice loss around Antarctica, but that's only really started to happen in the last 6 years. And so some of these trends are driven by very dramatic losses of ice in recent years. And so certainly when we add 10 more years, 20 more years of data, it's uncertain what will happen. But one key point is that once all sea ice is lost, clearly we will have maximized our solar absorption and that maximum warming will be occurring. But then when we flip to the Antarctic component, we've been saying that the Southern Ocean has taken up heat. That heat is deep in the ocean somewhere. And at some point, we might expect that warming to emerge at the surface of the ocean. And this is another highly uncertain point of at what point will the Southern Ocean heat uptake start impacting surface temperatures of the planet. The Southern Ocean is really important for mediating the surface temperatures of our planet. Without the Southern Ocean heat uptake, our planet would be a lot warmer than it is today. And there is uncertainty of on what timescales will that heat emerge back and start adding extra warmth to our planet. Importantly, NASA's made it a top priority to continuing these measurements of radiation from space, with follow-on missions in the next decade or two decades being reported to keep this record going, which is positive to hear.
Adding it up, what can this analysis of Big Earth data tell us about polar influences on the climate in the rest of the world where we live?
Yeah, apart from this direct warming in the Arctic, the global impacts are highly uncertain, like I mentioned before. And this is actually an ongoing question in our research group here in Wisconsin-Madison. Since our climate system is directly controlled by the energy, we would certainly expect that changing the energy balance would impact our weather, maybe through the frequency or magnitude of the storms we experience. But this is pure speculation. Theoretically, there should be an impact, but we're not sure exactly what that impact will be.
From the University of Wisconsin-Madison, we've been speaking with New Zealand Fulbright scientist Hamish Prince. He is lead author of the new paper, Observed Energetic Adjustment of the Arctic and Antarctic in a Warming World. I will post a link to the helpful abstract, and the paper will be available once it's formally published later this month. Follow up with more discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Hamish, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Agriculture is a major driver of toxicity, soil and species loss, and climate change. We all know that. If you don't live in Europe, and even if you do, it is hard to understand what farmers blocking roads with tractors has been about. According to a new editorial in the flagship journal Science, these are signs of resistance to laws designed to protect nature and a livable climate. They call it greenlash. Here is the explanation from Guyon Chaperon, professor in the Department of Ecology at Grimso Research Station in Sweden. The title is Reverse EU's Growing Greenlash. Quote, after several weeks of violent protests, European farmers have achieved a tactical triumph. that does not bode well for the future of environmental policies. In response to the demonstrations, the European Commission has enacted a derogation in the European Union's Common Agricultural Policy, called CAP, to set aside 4% of farmland for biodiversity and landscape protection, withdraw a bill to have pesticide use, removed a target to reduce agricultural emissions by 30% by 2040, and called for further changes in the CAP to loosen environmental requirements. These retreats reflect a lack of political commitment to policies aimed at greening European agriculture. Appeasing this green lash surely will not help Europe meet its environmental and climate challenges. The protesting farmers are demanding better consideration by politicians regarding the necessity of meeting environmental requirements, trade liberalization, and taxes. There is, however, barely any other economic sector in Europe that receives such glaring attention as farming. The EU allocates roughly one-third of its annual budget, 55 billion euros, to farming through its now 62-year-old CAP program. Farmer representatives have regular access to decision-makers at the highest level, European commissioners, heads of states or agriculture ministers across the EU, and no substantial policy change can be made without approval by the farming industry. This has made it impossible to modify the CAP program in ways that reduce the environmental impact of modern agricultural practices and promote sustainable farming. Grievances about costs, regulations, and bureaucracy by any economic sector are not surprising. However, the speed at which EU and national politicians abandon green policies reflects the strong penetration of industrial agriculture into decision spheres. Such capture of government by an interest group is dangerous. In France, for example, a special unit in the military police has been established to work with a farmer union to control environmental activism against industrial farming. In addition to EU-wide policy changes, farmers have obtained national concessions in Germany, Italy, Romania, and Spain that are mostly linked to taxes related to climate goals. The French government has gone further by proposing to ignore a court rule mandating a reduction in pesticide use while casting suspicion on the integrity of scientists working at the pesticide regulatory agency. Is this green lash a benefit to all farmers? The EU's about-face measures are unlikely to support small farms that are truly economically struggling and instead answer the wish list of industrial farmers. In France, the farming profession displays high inequality, with a minority of wealthy industrial farmers reaping most of the public subsidies. A 7-year investigation, published last year in a book that won France's top journalism prize, found that the farming sector was under tight control of a cartel of industrial agriculture groups acting in concert with the larger farmer unions to control the supply of seeds and tools, bank loans, access to land, and the purchase of harvests in a system likened to feudalism. This in no way favors more environmentally friendly farms. Economic hardship for farmers is neither caused by a lack of consideration by politicians nor by environmental policies, but rather by an agro-political system that, regardless of evidence-based policies, is tightly controlled by those who benefit from it. How will this economic sector become sustainable if those controlling it uphold a business model that is incompatible with sustainability? Making agriculture sustainable is unlikely to be achieved if policies do not account for this institutional capture by Big Ag. Much can be learned from scholarship and expertise in political science, law, and sociology, fields that have long studied how special interest groups organize political pressure to influence policy. But actionable knowledge is also needed to understand how such political pressure can be neutered. Inspiration might be found in the European Banking Authority's stress tests that examine how banks cope with adverse economic scenarios. Environmental policies could be stress tested by an independent authority to determine whether they can withstand a hostile political climate, for example. Strengthening systems by exploring how they can go wrong or whether they can be deliberately made to fail is often referred to as red teaming. This approach could help guide the development of green policies that are still effective, even when the political context becomes unfavorable. With next June's European Parliament elections possibly reinforcing this green lash, it is more important than ever to try different approaches. Guillaume Chaperon. You should also see a policy brief called Debunking the Backlash, Uncovering European Voters' Climate Preferences. It says, for example, the notion of a broad green backlash is set to dominate this year's European election campaign. Based on a new survey data from more than 15,000 respondents in Germany, France, and Poland, we show that it is largely overblown. A majority of voters still wish for a more ambitious climate policy and would support a raft of concrete measures to bring down emissions. So there you go. And you can find the same thing in the United States, where the agricultural lobby has totally dominated Congress for far too long, and really there's hardly any talk of them measuring up to climate change requirements that we need to survive, to stop the storms, the floods, and the fires. Same thing going on in Canada and almost every other country. So we need the farming community to get on board to save the climate that they need to produce crops that they can market and feed the world and sell to the world. And if they want to sink the ship in the meantime for the profit of industrial agriculture, which is often owned by giant corporations and companies on Wall Street, then we're not going to make it to a climate that we can survive, and we're going to run out of food, or at least certain places in the world will run out of food. I will put links to this article about the overblown backlash and the green backlash in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Be sure to take a look at that. Humans in crisis can be like passengers on a sinking ship. We rush from side to side. Now, with extreme weather and rising tides pounding, we can only rush into a more sustainable future. If we rush back towards the comforting past, everybody goes down with the ship. Pessimists expect a series of highly announced green laws and regulations, lots of enthusiasm, followed by regressive politicians promising to throw them all out, or at least water everything down while emissions continue to climb. This is looming in Canada, the United States, the Netherlands, the UK, almost everywhere. Few of us understand what a hostile climate means, arriving in a damaged and depleted environment. No country is prepared for changes at 2 degrees of warming, much less 3 degrees C and beyond, and that's where we're heading. We are currently creating that future, almost subconsciously. Fossil fuel companies with their banks and investors have decided it's okay. The United States was again the world's largest fossil fuel producer, for the fifth year in a row at least. The UK government claims that country needs lots more methane gas power plants. Australian politicians keep promoting their coal and gas exports. Canada's super tar sand pipeline, still not open, has cost over $34 billion. Nobody wanted to build that, so the government did. Oh, great.
Well, the fireworks are over. Only the smoke remains.
It's just one big blind party, the last party, before the fire. The fire sale of the atmosphere and the children's future continues to be profitable. What an epic struggle. We now determine if the poles have ice, if crops grow, if anywhere can be safe, if the weather can ever be depended on, if coastal cities go under. Welcome to the fulcrum of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening again this week. Be kind to yourselves, and thank you for caring about this world.
I've got to change this thing.